I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. President Trump used the word carnage to describe the state of the country at his inauguration last year. Last night at his first State of the Union address, he talked about common ground, one American family, a new American moment, and that there's never been a better time to start living the American dream. While the economy continues to improve, which normally results in popularity for a president, Trump's approval rating is at 37%, according to the Pew Research Center. Democrats countered with five responses. You heard that right, to Trump's speech. We asked Philip Bump to join us. He's national correspondent for the Washington Post covering politics. And Philip Bump, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
Was the president the right messenger to deliver this message, not entirely of cooperation and compromise, but was he the right speaker?
Well, I mean, he was unavoidably the speaker, right? I mean, it's certainly, if there were a Republican president who made the case that Donald Trump made last night in broad strokes, it's possible that the reception could have been different because that Republican president may not have had 1 year as president and 1 year as president and candidate combined, who had said a lot of very divisive things, advocated a lot of very divisive policy positions. And I think that part of the challenge that Trump faces is that we have seen repeatedly that he is able to give speeches that include rhetoric, which in another context might be appealing, that's then quickly undercut on Twitter or in interviews by what most people assume is his real feeling about working with the opposition.
In fact, I've seen more and more there's teleprompter Trump and then there's Twitter Trump. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, that is absolutely true. I mean, it is both a clever way of looking at it and an accurate reflection of the two sides of the president.
Any tweets this morning so far?
So far, no. So we'll see. I mean, one of the things that we saw last year after he gave his joint address to Congress, which got generally positive reviews, is that he seemed pretty content with that, and he seemed pretty happy. And then that all fell apart after questions were raised about Attorney General Jeff Sessions' meetings with Russians. And then by the weekend, Donald Trump was accusing President Obama of having wiretapped Trump Tower. So we'll see. So far, you know, it's been, 12 hours. So far, so good.
Well, and there's a lot going on behind the scenes, which I do want to talk to you about. Obviously, immigration is an important issue in Washington, D.C. It's something that he raised last night. But he framed it in many ways by that just tragic story of the parents who lost two daughters to this horrifying gang called MS-13. But he seemed to paint immigrants with that brush.
That's exactly right. I mean, he's done this literally from the first moments of his presidential campaign, and people remember his speech when he announced his candidacy was predicated on Mexicans are sending criminals across the border, that's why we need a wall. He has consistently argued that immigrants are a vector for crime in the United States, despite research demonstrating repeatedly that immigrants actually have commit crimes at lower rates than Americans, native-born Americans do. But he has this sort of overarching rhetorical argument, which is that immigrants are bad for the United States, and he has consistently, and last night wasn't the first time, used crime as a way of making that argument. People may remember he gave a big speech out on Long Island last year during which he did exactly that. He extrapolated outward from an MS-13 presence in Long Island to immigrants at large and the need for a wall on the border and so on and so forth. This is something he's done consistently, and I think that too goes back to your first point, which is that is not the sort of argument that is going to endear him to a lot of people who weren't already on his team.
He talked about the four pillars of immigration, including DACA, more than a million DACA recipients at some point, I believe over a 12-year period, getting access to citizenship. He talked about the wall. He also talked about family reunification or chain migration. And you had a really interesting piece, Philip, about how chain migration brought us the Trump White House. Can you expand on that?
So when Donald Trump says chain migration, he's referring to an immigration policy by which the relatives of citizens or immigrants are given priority in terms of consideration for entering the United States. So in other words, if you're a citizen and you have a cousin, I shouldn't say cousin because that's not
that's right.
There, you have a family member who fits the criteria and you want to bring them to the United States, they will be given, they can be given sort of bumped up in the queue, as it were. Historically, it has been the case that as immigrants came to the United States, they would often bring family members over. And that's something that happened to a great extent with members of the Trump administration. Donald Trump's mother came over and joined her sister in Queens, back in the 1930s, I think it was. His grandfather, Frederick Trump, came over and joined a family member as well. Mike Pence's grandfather joined a brother in the United States who himself had joined an aunt in the United States. Stephen Miller, who's sort of the architect of a lot of this hard-right immigration rhetoric from the White House, he too has family members who came over to the United States to join family members that are already here. That is the process which Trump now derides as chain migration, but it was a deliberate policy decision by the United States to unify families in the country, which now is being seen by the Trump administration as a negative.
I mean, it's how many people came to this country, not just the people in the Trump administration.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, one thinks of the sort of the historical narrative of American immigration, and it is that, you know, if some 16-year-old kid gets on a boat, comes over, gets off at Ellis Island, the next thing you know, he's writing back to his cousin, and his cousin comes over. I mean, you know, we've seen movies like this 100 times. This is sort of the story of American immigration to a large extent. But it is now, in part because the Trump administration broadly wants to limit immigration to the United States, it is now portrayed as being something that is anathema to the goals of the country.
How do you think that's going to play out as Congress debates this issue? And it's obviously more than just that, but it is the wall, DACA, and more.
Right. I mean, this is, you know, we exist in a moment of extreme polarization, which makes coming to compromise on pretty much anything fairly tricky. I mean, we haven't seen real compromise on something with any sort of contentiousness in a while, I think. And this is a very contentious issue. This is an issue in which the two parties hold pretty radically different positions even prior to Donald Trump becoming president, and he has further radicalized the position of the Republican Party. Yes, he advocates for a path to citizenship for these 1.8 million Dreamers who he identified in his speech last night, but his party's probably not going to go along with that. Huh. He advocates for this change to chain migration. Democrats are going to have a problem with that. It would be hard for him to put together an agenda which both parties could embrace simply because of the political moment. But the problem is he has actually widened that gap, not narrowed it.
We should add that changing or reforming immigration has eluded previous presidents, not just this one. Let me quote something that the president said last night. He said, "So tonight I call on the Congress to empower every cabinet secretary with the authority to reward good workers and to remove federal employees who undermine the public trust or fail the American people." Philip, that's been interpreted in a variety of different ways. How do you read what the president was saying there?
I think that one of the defining characteristics which we tend to overlook when we're considering President Trump is that he came to this job from a position that he held for decades as CEO of a business. And I think that he has been frustrated repeatedly by the constraints that a president faces, which a CEO does not. And I think that this fits with that broadly, which is that if someone isn't performing their job, he wants to be able to fire them without any questions asked. There is, however, historically, good reason for there being added protections for federal employees, which is that we haven't wanted the federal bureaucracy to be able to be swept out and then refilled with people who are loyal to a particular president or ideology. It has been seen in the past as a good thing to have continuity in the federal government and to make it harder for there to be a massive change in the government to be refilled with loyalists. It'll be interesting to see what actually happens with this. There is a lot of bureaucracy that comes into play here. But I think that's one of the things that people are a little worried about.
And some have interpreted it as a kind of a loyalty test, as Comey and others have said, that if you're not loyal to the president, your job is in jeopardy. Let me ask you about this memo. First of all, who's read this memo? And this is coming from the House Intelligence Committee, voted to be released, put together by the committee chair, Devin Nunes, voted entirely by Republicans on that committee, no Democrats.
That's right. So this is a memo, just to do a quick bit of context, this is a memo that was compiled by staffers for Devin Nunes. Nunes has been a very strong ally of President Trump's. People may remember that he was the one who Trump leaked some, or staffers for the White House leaked some information to Donald Trump, or to Nunes, in the spring of last year to defend those wiretapping comments that Trump had made on Twitter. So Nunes has been a strong ally. Some of his staffers wrote a memo that apparently makes the a case that the FBI misbehaved in its application for a warrant to survey someone who had been affiliated with the Trump campaign. So far, it's only been seen by some members of the House, and now over the weekend, the FBI Director Christopher Wray got a chance to look at it. He has already weighed in and said that it has inaccuracies. It seems pretty clear, based on the evidence at hand, that this is a memo that essentially was created to make the case for reasons that the FBI should not be trusted, and that that case was being made as part of the broader defense of President Trump from the investigation of Robert Mueller. But again, it is a classified document that itself points to further classified material, so even if it is made public, there will still be subtext to it that no one will be able to see because it points to classified documents, so it's going to be hard to contextualize it even if it becomes public.
The Democrats have their own memo countering the Republicans' memo. And then last night, you tweeted this, but last night as Trump was leaving the House chamber, Representative Jeff Duncan, he's a Republican from South Carolina, asked him whether he would release the memo. And I guess it's the ball essentially is in the president's court. And Trump responded, apparently, don't worry, 100%. How do you interpret that?
I will say, stepping aside from his comment last night, it seems pretty clear that Donald Trump would love to have this memo out there because it makes the case that he has been making, which is that the FBI can't be trusted in its investigation of him. It's the case, I think, that isn't a particularly robust one, but it's the one that Trump wants to make. That particular comment, though, it's hard to interpret what he said. He sort of, you know, it's people who've watched the State of the Union know that as the president enters and leaves, he goes through this sort of gauntlet of legislators wanting to shake his hand and say hi to him. This is him on his way out. The camera just happens to be there having a quick conversation. To me, honestly, it looked like he was sort of being sarcastic as though saying that it wasn't quite that easy a decision. It's hard to read, but there's little reason to suggest that Donald Trump really has a whole lot of qualms about releasing this thing.
And we have about 30 seconds before we have to say goodbye to you. Is Rod Rosenstein, is his job on the line?
I mean, I think that anyone who puts Donald Trump in an uncomfortable position and who Trump has the ability to put pressure on in their employment probably should be worried about the status of their employment. I mean, there are a lot of political issues at play, and Donald Trump could pay a price for firing Rod Rosenstein, but that doesn't mean that he wouldn't.
We're going to end on that note. Philip Bump, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And he's national correspondent for the Washington Post covering politics. We're going to take a very short break and then shift gears talking with novelist Alif Shafak. She's got a new book, Three Daughters of Eve. Stay with us. We'll be right back.